Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest on this episode is Michael Gabriel, and we will be discussing Frank Herbert's Dune, the co-winner of the 1966 Hugo Award for Best Novel. Michael is co-host of the podcast Trivially Crucial, and I'm going to chat with him a bit about that before we head into discussion of the actual book. So, Michael, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
Sure. And we had kind of connected on the Incomparable Supergirl Super Podcast and got to dialoguing about books at some point. And I know that Dune came up and I kind of latched onto that. And I ended up having to kind of go back and ask, are you sure you want to actually do that or do you want to pick something else off the list? But it sounds like this is one that that you have some history with.
Yes. Dune is probably one of my very favorite novels, just partially because of when I started reading it and just where it was in my development as a reader. So it means a lot to me.
Cool. Well, before we kind of follow up on some of that stuff, I want to ask you a little bit about yourself. I know that you have a podcast, Trivially Crucial. So why don't you talk a little bit about that? How long you've been doing that?
A few years now. It's actually a little bit fuzzy how long my friend Mandy and I have been doing this together. We've known each other since college at Georgia Tech several years ago, and we found ourselves frequently having phone calls after she moved out of state that would last multiple hours long about random sci-fi and fantasy and other thematic things. And these were the kinds of things that conversations we would have that friends would be listening to us talk about and just,
right.
And so they would just listen and we would just sit there and talk back and forth with occasional interjections from others. And we decided, you know, maybe we should do a podcast and just record these conversations. And so our first listeners, and probably most of our listeners, are still people who knew us in person in college.
Cool. And so why don't you give us a little bit of a pitch for kind of what you do on that podcast?
Cool. So Trivially Crucial is a podcast sometimes about themes, but largely it's about stories and how significant they are to us. The title actually comes from an Isaac Asimov quote where he says, and this is the quote itself, individual science fiction stories may seem as trivial as ever to the blinder critics and philosophers of today, but the core of science fiction, its essence, the concept around which it revolves, has become crucial to our salvation if we are to be saved at all. And so the word trivial and crucial are both in there somewhere. Yeah. And it's just the general concept that a lot of people diminish fiction, fantasy, science fiction as being unimportant, whereas we both Mandy and I believe that really it's through the lens of storytelling that we can develop a much greater understanding of the world around us and how it can change, hopefully for the better.
Yeah. Cool. I like it. So what about you, your kind of history as a nerdy type?
So my parents are both immigrants and they are not super nerdy. English is their third language. They didn't really they both came here from Egypt. They got married in Egypt and moved here about 2 years before I was born. So Arabic was their first language, French was their second, English was their third. And most of my geekdom or nerdiness is self-developed. My mom liked Star Wars, I guess, but that's about it. They are not big readers, even in native tongue. They're not big on science fiction, fantasy things. In fact, my mom has gotten more into nerdy things by proxy of me than the other way around. As a kid, I just started getting into video games and books and science fiction. Really, after I kind of went through the entire children's section of the library as a kid, science fiction as a genre just really, really grabbed me. And then eventually fantasy did too. But science fiction was really my path to greatest nerdiness. Probably my interest in technology and so on came through science fiction.
Cool.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, you were born in the U.S. Did you grow up bilingual or did you grow up just speaking English?
So I am bilingual, but it's sort of a rough fluency. When you talk household Egyptian Arabic, I am pretty darn fluent and never have any trouble understanding conversations. I can sit down with my parents and watch a movie. And as long as it's bounded to people talking in the home, I have no problem following without subtitles at all. Occasionally, I have to ask what individual words are that I can't pick up from context. But as soon as you get into any kind of technical vocabulary that is outside of the context I knew it in, which is, you know, my parents speaking to me or my grandmother who knew nothing other than Arabic speaking to me when she would stay with us, I start to get lost.
Okay.
And Arabic is also a funny language in that, especially Egyptian Arabic, in that Egyptian Arabic is very easily understood by Arabic speakers around the world because of Egypt's dominance in media in the Arabic world. But it's very hard for Egyptian Arabic speakers who don't have tons of exposure to understand standard Arabic. So I have a much harder time if I'm watching a Lebanese broadcast or something like that. I have to do a lot of mental translation. They use different sounds, they use different words. It's a lot like, say, American English to British English, except the differences are sometimes more pronounced. And then writing is even more difficult because it's not just a matter of learning a different alphabet, whereas, you know, when I did high school French, I actually have an easier time reading French now than understanding it verbally. But the grammar structure is entirely different in most written Arabic from spoken, partially because of Islam's kind of grounding of the written language, while modern Arabic is still definitely different in, say, a newspaper from in the Quran. It definitely has had an influence in how much or how little standard Arabic or how much Arabic changes in written form versus colloquially as they speak.
So that makes sense. I'm kind of a language nerd. I mean I'm not fluent in any other language but English, but I'm fascinated by like linguistics and how language changes, and so that was an interesting tidbit about kind of the Quran being a moderating influence on changes to the language. And I don't think I ever knew that there was a, you know, that there were different dialects of Arabic, but it totally makes sense.
Yeah. And some of it, of course, I mean, you go to different areas of the world and you get just different amounts of interest and, of course, different amounts of influence from different languages. Egyptian Arabic has a lot more French influence in it. Growing up, there were a lot of words people would say to me and I had no idea that the word that I thought was the Arabic word was actually just really poorly pronounced French until I got older and I started to learn French a little bit. And I was like, wait a minute, that looks awfully familiar. And I would talk to my parents and then they would have to really, really, they would probably have a 5-minute discussion trying to figure out what the actual Arabic word is because they're just so used to using the French one.
Nice. Well, as it happens, we're talking about a book that features some kind of Arabic sounding language in it.
Absolutely.
Or at least terms. And so I'll be interested to get your analysis of how different things should be pronounced, because I'm sure that I don't do it right all the time. But yeah, let's go ahead and talk about Dune. And usually, you know, I would ask, why did you pick this book? But it was kind of came out of a conversation on Slack. But it does sound like this is a important book to you. So why don't you talk about some of your history there?
Sure. It came out of nowhere, sort of, because most of my nerdy things have been self-directed or, you know, directed by friends. It was a high school that a friend of mine made a reference to Dune, and I had no idea what he was talking about. And he was just really surprised by that. And so he loaned me his copy of Dune. And he had mentioned to me that there were a few other books in the series too. And I came back the next day and I was like, so where's the second book? Because I had gone home and done nothing else and just finished Dune in a single night.
Wow.
and he of course didn't realize I was going to read through it that quickly, and he promised he would bring the next couple of books the next day, and so I just took the book back and read it again the second night.
Wow.
Yeah, it was since then I've gone through and I read a lot of the series. I read all six of Frank Herbert's books, and I read six of the prequels, cuz this is about the time when Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson started working on some prequel books. And eventually I just lost interest, as generally happens with everybody who gets into the Dune series, it seems like.
Yeah, I think there's like 18 books that tie in some way.
I think the number has gotten higher than that.
Has
now.
It? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. I had a friend who advised me early on. Because I told him I was reading Dune, and he said, you know, there's six books in that series. My recommendation is just stop after one. And that's what I ended up doing. I did at some point start listening to Dune Messiah on audio, but it never grabbed me, and so I've just never really been tempted to go back to it.
That is absolutely the recommendation I give to people now, too. Now that I'm past the high school and college phase of, well, I mean, I'm still kind of a nerd who wants to complete things.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But, and I understand that push, but really, in hindsight, Dune as a standalone novel is better than Dune as a series. I mean, I don't regret reading the other books, but...
Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely think that the other works actually diminish Dune as an original novel. I think it stands alone better on its own.
Okay. It's interesting, though, because of the way the book ends, and we're not, you know, into spoiler territory here or anything yet, but it totally sets up a sequel. I mean, it sets up this world and then drops you off kind of at the end of where it would logically end, and then it can continue. But, yeah, just have never really continued. So
yeah, and I think for any encouragement for people who read the first one and are curious whether or not they should get into the others are really different. They each... book, or at least set of two books in that six-book series, the initial six-book series, has very different central themes. And the first one, like I said, I think that in order to fit the messages and themes of the other books, it inherently had to diminish the central point of the first, or the central points of the first. And so, so if you're satisfied with some of the stronger thematic elements in the first one, know that those get undermined later, and that might help deter you from feeling like you're missing something.
Yeah, I felt that way about the Hobbit movies, where I watched the first one, and I thought, this makes me think less of the Lord of the Rings movies. And so I'm not going to continue watching them,
because
I still like the Lord of the Rings movies. Okay, well, so let's kind of go into some non-spoiler discussions of the book. I always want to do that before getting into the nitty-gritty of spoilers, just so that if there's anybody out there who's on the fence, should I read this? Should I continue listening to this podcast? I want to give them a strong recommendation, kind of yay or nay. But I want to start with kind of a non-spoiler synopsis, elevator pitch kind of thing. And this book is really hard to do.
It's
not a simple plot. So I thought I'd give you a crack at it and
see what you come up with. Yeah, I actually have some details written down, and there was no way I could do a concise one that wouldn't leave some significant things that I find appealing out, but sure. I will give it a shot.
Okay, go for it.
So, in the distant future, humans are spread across the stars, and Paul Atreides, a boy of nobility in this era's feudal system of government, is thrust from his world into an entirely different desert world called Arrakis, which is nicknamed Dune. Politics, destiny, and mixed luck conspire such that he has to venture out into the wilderness with a handful of loyal people and find a life among the Fremen, who are the desert people who inhabit this planet. With time, he works to prove himself to them, to become a leader to them, and in the process comes into conflict with the most powerful people and organizations in the known universe over the planet Arrakis itself and its monopoly on production of something called the spice, which is a substance of incomparable value for a whole lot of reasons. That's kind of the general plot synopsis without getting into spoilers, yeah. I feel like.
Yeah, I think that's good. I'm curious, you pronounced the planet two different ways, and I was wondering if one of them was more proper.
I honestly don't know, because I have only really read this, and it doesn't mean anything to me, whether or not it should. It doesn't mean anything in terms of from anything else, and I have only watched the old film one time, and I fell asleep during it. Okay. So I don't really have any audible memory of how it's pronounced. I heard myself say it the first time, and then adjusted to how I think I've heard other people say it more the second time. But yeah.
Arrakis is what I've always heard, and both the 1984 film and the Frank Herbert's Dune from the Sci-Fi Channel said Arrakis as well, and so does the audiobook. But I was leaning on maybe. More expertise in pronunciation of, I mean, I suppose that doesn't sound like a Arabic word.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it to me. And I know that some of the other bits and pieces here and there are clearly, from what I understand, Frank Herbert intentionally made some things vague and intentionally made some particular words that he used hard to figure out exactly where the origins that he pulled it from are, partially right. Because of how many thousands of years in the future this is supposed to be.
Sure.
So,
yeah. And, you know, if you're going to use terms like jihad, then that's not subtle.
Right.
Well, so then at this point, I think maybe just kind of overall impressions. I mean, it sounds to me like you're a huge fan of it, having read it twice in one day. How many times do you think you've read it total?
probably 8 or 9 times at this point. And then I've, of course, flipped through just to read excerpts here and there countless times. Okay. It's been, I know that once you and I scheduled this, I started to attempt a reread, but I did not have time to fully reread it. So I ended up skipping around and making sure to just go on the internet and make sure and read a few synopses to make sure I didn't really forget any significant points. And also to kind of drive home the barrier between this and Messiah, because while I remember, while I've only read this one several times, the others I've only read once a piece, I still sometimes forget where this one ends and Messiah begins. So,
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, gone are the days of carefree youth and just being able to take a full day and evening to read a book.
Exactly.
It's adulting very hard.
Exactly. Like lots of adulting and lots of podcast preparation for other podcasts. And
right.
It's something. So I'm very into distance running. And I spend a lot of time running every week. And I try to use that time for podcasts and audiobooks. But it's still, the fact is, I'm even with things at an accelerated pace, I'm much faster actually reading than I am listening to things. And so it cuts into how quickly I can get into through various media. I have a couple other project ideas that will have podcast components to them in the future, but I've decided that if I do them, they're going to have to be sort of highly polished things where I finish a season at a time and then just put them out so I don't have to worry about sticking to a schedule later on.
It's interesting. You, my podcast co-host on Take Me to Your Reader, who was also my first guest for this podcast, we covered The Demolished Man, which was the very first Hugo winner. His name's Colin, and he always gives me crap about listening to things at accelerated speeds. But I always tell him, you know, you get through it faster and your brain gets used to it. So,
yeah, for years I fought that. And then eventually I just realized it's the only way I'm going to get through all of this stuff.
So this is, Dune is, it's like it's a science fiction book that, for me, I think I wouldn't like because of the way it kind of reads like epic fantasy in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a lot of, you know, technology and that kind of stuff in it. And it's got all that kind of world building in it that I don't appreciate in fantasy books. And so this is like you were talking about how you got into science fiction and then kind of into fantasy. And I've dipped my toes into fantasy, but it's just not my jam. And so it's kind of, I think, a credit to the storytelling in Dune and how skillful the world building is that I still just really, really enjoy Dune.
So this is absolutely, it's one of the notes that I have that really sticks out to me is this is a science fiction series, but especially the first novel where it's not, it is very much science fantasy in the vein of you can sort of, not sort of, you can absolutely see the inspiration to Star Wars in this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very much about the politics of people rather than the technology of people, where it feels like any of the technology and so on is a byproduct of what story Frank Herbert's trying to tell about the development of people and cultures itself. I mean, this is a common theme whenever people talk about science fiction is, you know, you do have hard science fiction where people like getting into the technology and so on, which I am absolutely a fan of, but a lot of the most successful science fiction is science fiction where it's the fact that it's a science fiction setting is really just a tool for telling stories about people. And that is very much what Dune is about. And it's very intricate in all the different ways where everything ties in to make it feel like a built world, the way, like you said, world building is central to it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I feel like the audiobook was really helpful just in knowing how to pronounce things, or at least having an example of how to pronounce them. It doesn't necessarily make them correct. I think a lot of times with audiobooks, you end up getting, you know, notes from an author about this is pronounced that way. And I was actually kind of shocked that there wasn't a pronunciation guide. I'm trying to think if there was one in the appendix of the version that of my Kindle version.
So I don't believe there's a pronunciation guide because... And this is something to note that in our versions, the appendices and glossary are significant, but I believe in the initial run, the glossary was printed as essentially the foreword or the prologue to the book.
Oh, okay.
I think. I could be misremembering that detail, but it is all written as if it's in-universe, so there's no reason for there to be a pronunciation guide.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of written like journal entries almost, and the way the chapters begin, you know, with excerpts from writings about Muad'Dib.
Yes.
Which is cool. So kind of moving into, before we start to go into spoilers, I want to kind of entice people to read it if it's the kind of book that they would like. And so with your more broad experience with science fiction and fantasy, can you think of kind of who might like this novel? Fans of what other book, what other property? Do you have thoughts on that?
I have thought about this quite a bit, and it's always very difficult.
Yeah.
There is not a lot else that's precisely like Dune. I would say Star Wars is, if you are somebody who likes to think about your literature and especially your fiction in a in an intellectual way and understand where it comes from, you can't really have a full grasp of where Star Wars came from without reading Dune. It's just so deeply entrenched there. I've only, for my podcast with Mandy, I've started my first run through of The Wheel of Time, which is one of her favorite series, and it is remarkable how often I can see very, very obvious inspiration there. Both superficial and deep inspiration in terms of themes and the way that certain organizations and peoples are sort of patterned after organizations and peoples in Dune. And that's not to say that Dune is the first place where any of these concepts come from, but to see so many of them woven together so intricately, I'm not aware of other places where Dune is seen the same way.
Sure.
Now, looking at similar-ish eras in science fiction, the Foundation Trilogy by Isaac Asimov, who I've mentioned to you before, he's my favorite author.
Right.
Although his book feels much more of the time in which he was writing than Dune does to me.
I agree.
And I like that for some of its charm, but I understand how it can be a little bit difficult for people to get into. Yeah. But I think the original Foundation Trilogy, which is nowhere near my favorite Asimov work, is very of a piece with Dune in that it is very much about political machinations and the way that society itself develops over time in a far-flung future far removed from ours.
Right. And large-scale considerations, too, not just limited to one planet.
Right, very much. It is both of these are kind of large-scale, galactic empire-level political machinations, which is fascinating. I have never gotten into Game of Thrones and the Song of Ice and Fire. Or Fire and Ice, or however you say that. And part of it is just other superficial things. I have a weak stomach for certain themes or certain presentation elements that are in the series. But the elements of it that are most appealing to me, which is the political machinations, really do seem to blend with some of the elements that might appeal to people in Dune.
Yeah, I read the first of those books and then thought, I probably won't get back to it. And but yeah, I definitely agree that some of the kind of political intrigue there is something that's similar. And that's kind of why I think of Dune in a lot of ways as epic fantasy, but also definitely science fiction. So it's confusing. It's like it's a genre straddling book.
It is. And that's a thing I'd like to talk about to try to encourage people to read this is I am unfamiliar with other books or as many books that really touch as many things, because this is a book, I mean, it contains faster than light travel and contains an organization of influential women with essentially magical powers. It's like essentially a group of witches. You have men trained to think like computers. You have genetic breeding programs. And then you have prescience, just, you know, visions of the future. You have laser beams and energy shields right alongside simple blade fighting, you know. And it's really a book about the nature of and the origins of myth, legend, religion, religious fanaticism, large political movements, how politics, economics, culture, like how all of that intertwines. There's also a long ecological sort of bent to it. And that's something that I feel like is much more difficult to do with fantasy than science fiction, because you can explore the ecology of the planet itself.
You have a character who's an ecologist, so
exactly, and he's important. And it is, and that plays into also like how is the ecology and the future of it, how is it affected by and does it affect the future economics and political situations, and how do, and you can see a lot of parallels to the real world in terms of how do political and economic interests affect the ecology and vice versa. And subjugation of nature and indigenous peoples for the sake of resources. Like, there's so much going on here that interleaves. And I think that the sci-fi setting, rather than a traditional fantasy setting, lends itself to that intermingling of especially the ecological aspect, in ways that you might not be able to do with purely fantasy.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty good enticement to get people to read this one. And, you know, it is a classic. It's stood the test of time. It's 50 years on, now 51. And I feel like one of the things about this book that makes it work and makes it kind of timeless is the fact that it doesn't really rely on the state of the art today.
Right.
And it doesn't rely so much on technology either, because it has those considerations like the suspicion of thinking machines and the use of body shields and so, you know, bladed weapons. And so it has a, like I said, a much more timeless quality. And I don't feel like in 50 years this one's going to age badly.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I mentioned Isaac Asimov earlier, and I love his work, but a lot of the time, but when I'm reading his work, I have to think about how funny it is that this is how he thought things would develop, you know, 50 years in the future, 60 years in the future. Oh, yeah. And even when he's doing stuff in the same far-flung, distant future, it feels like he doesn't remove it from the thinking of his time, whereas this, it really does feel so separated that it just feels like a whole and well-considered world in and of itself.
Right. Yeah, with Asimov in the robot series, you know, he didn't anticipate the transistor. How are you going to anticipate that? And so right. So all his robots have vacuum tubes.
Yeah, and that's one of the difficult things about, I mean, Asimov isn't necessarily hard sci-fi, but he's certainly harder than Dune is.
Agreed, and, yeah.
And it's one of the difficult things about hard sci-fi is, you know, sometimes our understanding of science itself is just not developed that far.
Yeah. Well, you ready to get into spoilers or any other non-spoiler talk to do?
I think I am ready to go.
Okay. So for anybody listening at this point, if you have not read Dune, you know, big red warning here, do not continue unless you are okay being spoiled. And just going to encourage you, it's a really good book. Don't be spoiled unnecessarily.
Yeah.
One thing that I'll put in the show notes is Tor.com recently did a Dune reread. And so there's, for each chapter, there's a little commentary section on it. And at the end of each kind of blog post for that, there's an excerpt from the audiobook. And so you get to kind of hear the quotes from each chapter being read. And then I think it trails off at some point after that. But it's one of the unique things about the book, the lead-ins by the Princess Irulan from sometime in the future, that are a little mysterious at places, but they always tie in really well, too, to what's going on in the chapter. And that's one thing that I really enjoy.
Absolutely. And one of the fascinating things about that is, of course, the first time through, you have no idea who she is.
Right.
And you don't know why it's important and why she is this person who seems to have some form of authority on writing about, you know, the life of Paul. But
Yeah, I think she doesn't actually appear in the book until the very last chapter.
Yeah, very, very end.
Which is something that they made a decision in the Frank Herbert's Dune sci-fi miniseries. It didn't sound like you had seen that one.
No, I have not.
So they beef up her role and bring her in much earlier.
Interesting.
Because, you know, her presence is definitely felt through the book, and especially on a reread, after you know kind of what her role is, that makes it, you get a little more of a sense for kind of where she's coming from. And it's got those bits about growing up in her father's house and then also all the tales about the Muad'Dib. But I thought it was an interesting decision from an adaptation to bring her in and have her be a more fully fleshed out character in the story.
Yeah, I've never actually watched any of the other adaptations aside from, as I mentioned earlier, the original movie, and even that I fell asleep. But I'm definitely interested in seeing way things have changed. I'm not a person who feels like things need to be slavish to the original material as long as, you know, you're respecting sort of the central themes.
So. Yeah.
I'd be interested to see how that works.
Make a good film, and, you know, another consideration is, you know, bring in, try and stick with the book to some extent, but I like to see some actual adaptation.
Yes. Adaptation rather than just, you know, mere rote translation, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. So one thing that came up in our discussion on Take Me to Your Reader was the use of the interior monologue in Dune, because lots of times you have a point of view character who you're in their head, right? Maybe it's told from first person, or maybe you just kind of know what's going on between their ears. In Dune, you kind of get that for all the characters at one time or another. And it's a fascinating choice, and I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
It's actually one of my favorite things that I feel separates this from other books I've read is I don't think it works in most circumstances, but Frank uses this really adeptly in that he switches in the same scene often between sort of the interior dialogue of the same characters. And so you're getting a full understanding of things where you're used to normally having a limited perspective. And so you sort of see this conflict in thought between different characters, and you just get a much fuller view of things. Especially, he starts so early with pretty heavy cognition and estrangement, and it never really leaves, where you understand some of the terminology he's using, and he uses it in the same breath with other terminology. So you're meant to be sort of off balance a lot of the time as you're trying to process through things, and having multiple perspectives all the time really helps you to piece things together as you go.
Yeah.
It allows it to be much denser in terms of how many new concepts you can be exposed to in just one book.
Yeah. That was one of the interesting things about the world building, was pretty early on you hear about the Landsraad and the Chom Company, and he doesn't explain any of it, but it's a tribute to how he writes that I kind of had confidence that, okay, if we need to know what those are, we'll get them from context, I'm sure. And there aren't many of those things. I can't pick out any particular thing that he dropped the ball on.
Yeah, I think by the end, you more or less understand any significant, you know, concept that you were not exposed to before. I mean, yeah, like you said, he really early on, you're exposed to the concept of the, or the, at least the wording of the Kwisatz Haderach, the Gam Jabbar, the, I don't know how people pronounce it, the Bene Gesserit.
Bene Gesserit is the way the movies have done it, and the audiobook.
Cool. Mentats, all of that. And you're introduced to those terms, and you're not explained what they are until later, really. Yeah. And I really appreciate that. You even have other things, you know, the Orange Catholic Bible is thrown out as a reference. It's like, well, I kind of understand what that must have come from a long time ago. And lots of other similar concepts where you see how various, you know, religions may have combined over time or been influenced by other events. And again, it gives you the sort of root, so you start to make some assumptions, but you know not to make too many. It's pretty great the way he just sort of leads you with breadcrumbs.
Right, so, right. Yeah, talking about the OC Bible, as a Bible reader myself, you know, I remember the first time kind of reading through it, and the first time that there was a quote that I was like, that's not in the actual Bible. it does give you that clue that, okay, this is something that came out of an ecumenical movement of some kind that combined multiple religions. And when you look in the appendix, you know, it does talk about that essentially there was this huge unification of earth religions, or planetary religions for all that. And it's an interesting bit of world building there. That's, you don't need that appendix to tell you that. You can get that from context if you're somebody who is conversant in the Bible as it is.
Right.
So I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, and I would even say that, you know, in our culture, I'm also a Bible reader, but in our culture, you know, people are exposed enough to the Bible.
Yeah.
And, you know, modern Western culture, that's probably enough for them to really understand where it's coming from. Yeah. In terms of that. And then there's other religions and faiths that are clearly combined in different ways that, you know, it's really interesting, of course, because the only one, and this is a really funny concept, but the only one that's not strongly represented is Judaism. I mean, you do get some of its influence, and you get a lot more, but I feel like you get a lot more influence from the language Hebrew rather than than the Jewish religion itself. And that actually becomes a plot point later in the series.
Interesting.
It's fascinating in that in the even more distant future from this book, essentially the Jews are still a group that who have left primarily unchanged because they've kept to themselves. It's a fascinating. It was a little bit jarring to me, and I'm still not sure I'm on board with the concept, but it was a really kind of fascinating plot decision that he made.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just from history, I can sort of see that too, because they were a people without a land for a long time and yet maintained their culture.
Yeah, absolutely. So becomes very central. If you're curious to see how that plays out, you have to keep reading until I think the fifth book maybe is when that comes up. So, Wow. Yeah, but along those lines, I guess, there's the language combination that we were talking about before, and that kind of goes along with this sort of religious, you know, blend. And a lot of that is, I mean, there's endless Arabic and Hebrew thrown in, and some of it I can tell is influenced by Arabic, but then you also get Persian in there. It's very fascinating the way that different ethnic groups have just become kind of blended together. I mean, you think about the empire, and it's the Padishah emperor, right? You know, and in first reading, I just assumed that the emperor would be essentially of European descent, but that's obviously my Western bias. And it's really interesting to see how these things go. I mean, you look at the names of the people close to Paul and his father. You know, you have Gurney Halleck, Duncan Idaho.
Thufir Howitt.
Yeah, Thufir Howitt. And it's like, those are very distinctly different name origins, right?
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And it's just fascinating how those go together. It actually does highlight one of the things that I find disappointing, and of course, this is me looking through the lens of today rather than then, it's one of the very few things, there's just a handful of things I feel like don't age well, is I noticed that there's essentially nothing of African origin in this.
Yeah, like, that is true.
And pretty much every other major Earth civilization, I mean, you have, it feels like you have a little bit in the way of at least South Asian influence and so on, but nothing of African descent. And I wonder if that's just a blind spot for Frank Herbert, because, you know, what, from his perspective or from Western perspective society when he was writing this, what significant African, you know, cultures were there? And unfortunately, right. That's an overlooked thing.
Yeah, because I think he lived in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
And, you know, in the 60s, I don't know what the ethnic makeup of was of Washington.
Right.
I live in Oregon now. I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and it's fascinating how much whiter Oregon is than Alaska. And I don't know if that's just because Alaska is a kind of place that you kind of have to move to deliberately, and so groups of people kind of come. And one of the things people are always surprised about when I'm like telling them when I played youth baseball that you just feared the Samoan teams. And they're like, Samoans? Why would Samoans move to Alaska? You know, Pacific Islander to Alaska, that makes no sense whatsoever. And yet, there it is. You know, I had a lot of Filipino friends growing up. And so it's... Yeah, it's interesting. And you kind of become a product of where you live, too. And so I think there may be, like you said, kind of a blind spot there in
right.
Dune. But there's definitely, I would say, if you're doing a future adaptation of Dune, you know, get some Black people in there.
I would agree, for sure. And I live in Atlanta, Georgia, which has a very large Black population.
Right.
I think I've heard people say that we are the Blackest major city in the United States, which would make sense given historical perspective and historical context. But... and it's just, it really stuck out to me when I was reading this.
It did to me too. And watching the adaptations recently, there's just the sci-fi miniseries is a very international cast, but it still doesn't have the kind of diversity that you want to see now from films.
For sure. And on that note, there's this weird underlying sexism in the book as well, where... there are only a handful of really significant female characters, even though you have the entire Bene Gesserit organization. And most of the women who aren't specifically conniving sort of, I mean, they're essentially witches, right? They are subservient to men in some way. I mean, they're essentially there to serve the world of men. And it's a very odd odd thing. I mean, even the Bene Gesserit, who are sitting there trying to, you know, they wield great power, they also, I mean, their end goal is to, and I'm sure I've had this discussion with many people, like their end goal is to bring a man into their domain and to grant a man their powers. And that is, you know, it didn't occur to me at the time, but given what I've learned in the however long it's been since I first read this, well over a decade, that really strikes me as odd now.
To bring about the male savior.
That
was something that struck me this time too, was I do feel like there are enough, well, I mean, this is a guy's perspective, right? I mean, I see characters like Chani or however you pronounce hers. You know, the fact that she answers challenges to Paul and the Reverend Mother, the place of the Reverend Mother in the Fremen society, you know, I kind of look at that and I'm like, that's cool that there's a position of influence and power there for females. And of course, it's been manipulated by the Bene Gesserit for, you know, however long. But yeah, it'd probably be good to have a female perspective on this one.
Oh, absolutely. And it's one of those things where as men, there's only so much perspective we can provide on this. And it's a trap that we very often fall into where if somebody identifies sexism, I feel like men as a whole, the immediate response is sort of this, but there's this strong woman right here,
right?
Exactly. You know, to object, where it's like, well, there's a difference between being strong and being truly independent. you know, right. and independent.
Having agency.
Yeah, having agency, exactly. And and a lot of, again, a lot of the women's roles are very much defined by the men's roles.
Yeah. Well, I'll be interested if you ever manage to convince Mandy to read it, to hear her perspective.
I hope to. She has enough of a... we talk enough about just purely from an intellectual perspective and a historical perspective as a piece of fiction that even though it's a bit drier to get through, especially early on, yeah. once you start going, I think she'll really appreciate it, especially because she's just a fan of so many things that have taken obvious inspiration from it.
Yeah. So one of the kind of non-traditional things I feel about Dune is there isn't a really obvious antagonist. You have the Harkonnens or Harkonnens, however... That's another one where I'm like, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, and it's, I've heard it different ways. But, you know, the Baron is kind of the main antagonist, and yet Paul isn't really dealing with him most of the time during the book.
Right. And I think this ties back to what I mentioned earlier when trying to convince people to read this, where the real antagonist is sort of the structures of human society. Mm-hmm. Right. I feel like that's really it. Like the Baron... and the Emperor, who are both really his opponent, right. His opponents, they are the both the products and also the people who continue to perpetuate the, you know, the society as it is and the way that it, you know, the way that it constrains people. I mean, even the Bene Gesserit, if you think about some of their objections, you know, there's the fight between the Reverend Mother and Jessica very early on in the disappointment because Jessica was supposed to bear a son. A daughter, and she chose to bear a son out of love for Duke Leto. Mm-hmm. And there's so much that goes into that because it wasn't just a matter of, oh, it was the next generation that we were planning to have a boy because we think that that's the greatest chance of us having our chosen one. Mm-hmm. But also underlying that, you have this sort of central theme of they are political manipulators. You know, they would have tried to marry her daughter to the next Harkonnen heir, and that would have ostensibly put off this upcoming battle for another generation or so. And so they're sitting there trying to manipulate things, and they're complicit in this, you know, they're complicit in, they want to keep this weird fiefdom thing going.
And they have the kind of almost eugenic consideration, right? They want to maintain these bloodlines.
Absolutely.
Of the true humans, which that's something that I feel like gets lost in a few places. Because you have that idea right at the beginning with the test with the Gom Jabbar, mm-hmm. where she's trying to test if he's human. And I don't totally understand, you know, the human-animal divide there.
I think that it is, in my read, and of course this is sort of my personal take, I think that it's not actually there and Paul objects to it, you know, and it's really a thing that they've convinced themselves of. So it's sort of their dogma, right?
Okay, sure.
It's their dogma that this is how we... have justified generations of us manipulating people and not giving them a choice in this. And so we decide, because you keep in mind, you can fail this test and prove that you're an animal, but they don't even give many people the test at all, right?
Sure.
Most people, they just decide that they're animals without giving it. And that really comes down to, if you think about how anybody who really belittles a particular group of people or, you know, or anything, is like, you either come up with a test that you know people are going to fail because of really a product of upbringing, and you use that as reinforcement marginalizing them, yeah. Or you just decide that, oh, well, they would have failed this test anyways, and you don't even bother. And that's, so I think that that's where the thread is, because in my mind, Paul does object pretty early. He's like, I don't agree with this characterization, because this means that my father is an animal, and that's nonsense, you right. know, because he does have a deep respect for his father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Bene Gesserit just sort of dismiss him out of hand.
Right.
It's Jessica's bloodline that's the more important. And that does come into it, right? Because you find out what her lineage actually is.
Absolutely. And it's a thing where Paul, of course, is, and thankfully, since we're in spoiler territory, when he's becomes the first person who's awakened to both bloodlines, to the memories of both bloodlines, both male and female, you know, he has a much greater perspective than they do, and he still continues to not agree necessarily with the human and animal conceit. So,
right.
So to me, that it really is just a false conceit that is sort of self-deception and justification on the part of the Bene Gesserit.
Okay. I'll bow to your more considered opinion on this, because it's something that had just kind of cropped up in my brain.
I haven't really ever had a debate on that point. It's just sort of my headcanon, if you will. And sure. And it hasn't really been... I feel like the rest of the series bears it out. But
okay.
Some of the other things that we only talked about a little bit is the technology.
Yeah.
And again, it's not a strong point in this, but it really, the way that technology works in this is so intricately woven with how the economics of it work.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is, of course, you know, blades are cool. So let's bring blades back. Well, how does this happen? And so you have personal shields. And just this fascinating system, it doesn't just end at that. It's not just that, hey, we need personal shields as a mechanism for getting people to use blades because projectiles are useless, you know, against personal shields. But it comes back later, too, when Paul is trying to prove himself in his fight to the death with among the Fremen.
Yeah.
And a big thing is, you know, for a while, people are laughing. They think he's being essentially disrespectful and playing with his opponent.
Right.
Because
his reflexes are all trained to shield fighting.
Exactly. And it's just this really neat thing where he keeps slowing down just to get through the shield. Mm-hmm. And therefore missing, because, you know, the Fremen are strong enough and powerful enough to dodge if you give them that opening. But Paul is faster, and he has to sort of overcome that hurdle of learning to fight without the shield.
Yeah, and I like that. And I look at that kind of the whole thing with the shields is that's a very science fiction thing to do, right? Let's take a piece of technology and say, how would that affect something, right? How would it affect society? And in this case, kind of how it affects fighting tactics. Because with the shields in existence, the personal shields and the larger shields, right? You have to worry about the laser gun shield interaction,
right?
Because that's a disaster. But then in just how it affects combat, and like you said, that projectile weapons don't do any good because anything fast is repelled by a shield. And I like you said, I do also love that then that implication is borne out when Paul is put to the challenge, that he has to overcome that and be able to fight without shields in place.
Yeah, it develops into this interesting rock, paper, scissors sort of fighting system because you have, of course, laser guns are incredibly useful if people aren't wearing shields.
Right.
But they're rendered useless against, you know, any targets of note because everybody can afford shields if they're rich.
Yeah.
And so you don't use those. Atomics have not been used in generations, like, you know, essentially atomic weapons, because they're not super useful against shields.
Right. And you can't use them against a human population or your planet gets destroyed.
Right, exactly. And so it's just this sort of thing where it gives a reason for them having gone to this sort of medieval fighting style where you're using blades and so on, but it's still not quite the same. Right. And that fits into this sort of fiefdom kind of governmental scheme that is an odd product of economics. So I really do love how so much of that is intertwined, and it makes the Fremen not completely, it makes it so that they're not entirely useless and not entirely helpless because, you know what? Everybody has to fight on foot.
Yeah. It's interesting to me, too, in the book, you have the Baron as this character that's sort of an antagonist, and he thinks of himself as very brilliant, you can tell. And yet, Reban, who's his blunt instrument nephew that he just throws against Arrakis to prepare them for a more benevolent dictator in Fade Ralta, Reban actually kind of has an instinct that, you know, Uncle, you might be underestimating the Fremen. And the Baron just shrugs that off, just dismisses it out of hand. No, this is just, it's a rabble in the desert, and I don't have to think about them.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things where intelligence and wisdom are very different.
Yeah.
And I do suspect that the Baron is smarter if you're just talking intelligence, but that's different. It's cockiness and a lack of humility can make for huge mistakes and does all the time in real life. And I agree. I think that's a really neat interaction there.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the Baron as a character? Because there's some problematic things
yes.
to a modern eye.
Absolutely. I agree. So I mentioned earlier that there were a few different problems that I had, and some of it was the sexism and the lack of African, you know, influence. The Baron and the depiction of essentially the two most disgusting characters in the movie is problematic. So you have the Baron and Piter, his mentat.
Yes.
And the two of them, I mean, the Baron is, he's fat, he's ugly. He is, I think, the only explicitly gay person recognized in the novel.
Yeah.
And that is troublesome as
he's a pedophile.
And he's a pedophile, too.
That you can kind of draw a false equivalency then. And that is not a healthy perspective.
Not at all. It's one of the few things that really feels like it's of the time in a really unhealthy way. Yeah. Does not age well at all. And similarly, Piter, while, you know, he's terrible for a whole bunch of reasons, he's also kind of described as feminine in nature. And yeah. And that's, again, it's this sort of thing. It's like, these are really easy ways to make you know, hey, you're supposed to dislike this person. It's right. Like a really bad, but unfortunately common shorthand, and still sure. Unfortunately too common now, but much yeah. less common. Definitely problematic. Otherwise, I mean, aside from that, I appreciate their just brutality. Yeah. And their, because of the nature of their brutality and their how little they think of others, the areas in which they underestimate others.
The blind spot they have.
Right. So Piter, again, he's obsessed with Lady Jessica. And one of his things is he did not predict, because he's a mentat and he makes all kinds of predictions, he didn't predict her choosing to have a son instead of a daughter.
Right.
And not many others would, but perhaps a mentat who understood people a little bit better might have.
Sure. You know? Yeah. Piter's a little rapey, too.
Yeah.
The fact that he wants the Lady Jessica, you're like, that's not going to go well for her.
But at least that fits with this, hey, he's just a really terrible person.
It does. Yeah. Well, and also it fits into that idea of the mustache twirling villain who has a complete blind spot, because she's more than a match for him.
Oh, absolutely.
So I kind of wanted to see them interact and her kick his butt.
He got his comeuppance, though. So
he did. Yeah. Yeah. I did think it was kind of cool, though, kind of going back to the consideration of the female characters, that in the initial meeting between Jessica and Paul and the Fremen, that she is the one that overpowers Stilgar. And the way he respects her so immediately and says, look, I know what use you are to this tribe.
Yes, I definitely appreciate that. I would actually say, and I don't think this is, I'm anywhere near the first one to say this, Lady Jessica is probably, to me, the most interesting character in the novel. She has so much ability, and she lends herself as useful to others, but is so respected by those around her for the most part. She's underestimated frequently, but at the same time, very often has people who have a proper estimation of her as well. I love how nuanced she is and how important she is to many. And like you said, she can prove her worthiness of respect in an instant if given the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And she does over and over again. Really, and I appreciate her, and I appreciate Stilgar and the way that he very quickly decides to see her value, you know?
Yeah, I like that, you know, he even deliberately says, look, let's dispense with the idea that you're going to become my woman or something, mm-hmm. because I can see that we could be partners, essentially, without the, you know, the sex thing getting involved.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's see. I have down, you know, to talk about themes and things that are unique about the book. I feel like we've been covering some of that, but I want to let you, if you have things left on your draft board, to pull them out now.
Sure. I think one of the largest themes in this, of course, and we mentioned it briefly before, is this idea of religious fanaticism and how it develops, or even, you know, political fanaticism.
Yeah.
And how what it takes to whip people into a frenzy in order to get what needs to be done is one thing, but being able to contain them after the fact is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating the way that Paul, even when he gets the ability to see the future, he sees this danger and he knows he has to sort of do what's necessary to a certain degree. And then after that, there's sort of this tightrope walk to avoid getting carried away in their jihad.
Right.
And he fails at that, right? Mm-hmm. He fails in the end. It's like their jihad is going to carry on. And so it's a matter of what he deals with afterwards. And you get into that in Dune Messiah. But
Well, it's kind of like he runs up against the limits of prescience as well.
Right.
Because he's trying to see a way out of this. This must not happen. This jihad must not happen. And I think, and you can correct me, I mean, you've read it more than I have. I've only read it twice and listened to it a couple times. But it seems like at some point he just goes, you know what, it's going to happen and there's nothing I can do to stop it.
I agree, because I think, of course, the way that they do prescience in this is really neat, where it's not really, there are so many different outcomes and you can sort of see all of them and essentially their likelihood. It's a sort of science fiction take on prescience, right?
Yeah.
And so it's almost like he can see the branching timelines and kind of cut different ones off. And he's the only one who can do that because he can see them. And he sort of, I mean, he could just lose and therefore cut off the jihad, and that would be a way to do it. But that's a worse outcome to him, presumably, than
well,
you know.
Well, even then, it at some point, he sees that even if he dies, they would carry on in his name.
Oh, that's true. So, yeah, but I agree. He does sort of, at some point, essentially give up. And that is borne out later on. It's one of the things that isn't, it's sort of undermined, but not necessarily, where it's like, yes, this is how things should go. Let me just make it as little bad as possible. It's going to be bad, but let me diminish the damage done.
It's going to be a tiny little calamity.
But on those lines, too, and his prescience kind of falls into this, is sort of fate and defiance of it is a very big thing in this. You know, as kind of religious people, I'm sure that you and I have both had discussions on the nature of fate and free will before. And it really, it's a topic that lends itself well to something so steeped in religion as this book is. I think, you know, you have all kinds of things. Jessica breaking sort of what she, you know, for thousands of years of breeding, the Bene Gesserit have been following this thing. And then Jessica breaks it one generation early.
Right.
And it's almost like a, well, you can get into the endless discussion over whether this would have happened and was the way it needed to happen or not, or whether it would have, or whether it decreased the chances of success, but success happened anyways. You know, and it's a matter of, well, how much do they really know? You know, how much of, can they really see that means that this is definitely the way things should go? And would this breeding system inherently give them somebody who's just much more likely to defy their, you know, what they wanted in order to have the person who is at this point, in that it's Lady Jessica? So that's fascinating to me. Paul, of course, being able to see the future and seeing what should happen, and he tries and does defy some types of fate, but of course, as we just said, he fails in some respects. And and yet he still has to pay attention to all the actions of people around him, because no matter what he can see is most likely to happen, the fact that he's trying to move out of lockstep with his, you know, with particular outcomes means that he is subject to things that might not have happened otherwise.
Yeah.
And he has to be aware of that. And that's that sort of theme of fate is not a thing that changes heavily through the series. It's one that keeps being discussed, which is nice. And then I guess, you know, it's a point that ties back to this religious thing that we just talked about, is Paul sort of like, what is his responsibility as this leader? Like, he doesn't necessarily believe in himself as you know, he's just a person who has this ability, but he doesn't necessarily think he's the Messiah of sorts, you know, but he obviously realizes, well, this responsibility is mine and I am this person to these people. So what is my responsibility therein? Like, how much can I diminish this jihad and how much should I?
And yeah, he's kind of aware of his own narrative at points where he's like, I know that I wasn't really involved with this battle, but they'll say that I slew 20 men myself.
Right.
And so it's like he doesn't believe his own press, but he knows, you know, he knows that it's there.
Yeah. And it of course, you know, if you think about the nature of the Abrahamic religions, and, you know, we've got three of them, right? We have Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And inherently, if you believe in one, then you believe that the others are missing something, right? And it's sort of the, you know, if you're a believer in Christianity, then you can read a lot of this into sort of the nature of Muhammad and Islam and like what's going on there. Like, how much of that faith, if I believe that faith is incorrect, then how much of that faith do I believe is, you know, grounded in what he really believed in himself versus what he felt was necessary at the time? And the same could be said of people who don't believe in, you know, in Jesus Christ and sort of the faith that came from him and from the apostles and so on. And I think there's a lot
written by his followers and in following generations. Yeah,
exactly. And so I think there's a lot of value, again, as a religious person. Like, I think that it's really valuable to see sort of to think about this sort of human perspective and how stories and religion can potentially change with time and how that might influence my beliefs.
Yeah. I think to kind of dovetail on the religious questions is the whole idea of the missionaria protectiva, that they go to primitive worlds and seed beliefs on them that will be beneficial should any Bene Gesserit end up on that planet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's a fascinating thing. And it makes you think then, you know, from the perspective of someone who has taken a story from ancient times, you know, for us, Christianity, if you were on one of these planets, what kind of assurance would you have that the faith that you held was based on anything? And that's something that's fascinating to think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the things with sometimes with fellow Christians, the sort of obstinance, blind unwillingness to question and to think about the origins of how things can go. I shouldn't say it gets on my nerves, but it frustrates me sometimes because I feel like, you know, we should be striving to understand better how we might be compromised, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We should hang out.
We should, if only we lived anywhere near each other.
Well, anything else to talk about Dune?
Yeah, I think so. This is much more superficial, and it's in the vein that sometimes I just really like concepts in sci-fi novels. It's sort of the way that they have no robots, no computers, is an interesting thing. It's not the only piece of science fiction. Obviously, I mentioned Foundation earlier, and they have no robots or in the future. In that either. And I don't really believe that that's a possibility. I think that really, no matter, humans are not disciplined enough, that no matter how terrible an incident we have, that makes it very clear we should never have robots and thinking machines, we'll still make them. Like, because, you know, we'll forget in a generation and then we'll be like, you know what? This is pretty convenient. we should have these doing our grunt work.
Yeah, I get the impression with this, though, that it's so far future that they had kind of already, they'd kind of already experienced the negative part and then made it outlawed.
Right.
But that's the kind of thing that's kind of hard to control on a universe level.
Exactly. And they actually address this in some of the prequels and so on, is it's during the Butlerian Jihad and the Machine Crusade and so on. There is essentially a fight against sentient machines. And humanity wins at great cost, and from that point on, machines are off limit, which is why you have mentats and so on to kind of emulate the benefits of computers.
Right.
It's actually one of the things where the Baron says at some point, he's like, you know, machines would be really convenient for this kind of thing that we're using people for, because if you look at the way that we have to manipulate, I think he's trying to indicate to Fade Rotha how they can use Piter by, you know, using him because of his spice addiction. And he's like, well, machines aren't subject to this kind of thing. We just make them do what we want. And, you know, even if you had a thing where everyone agreed the morally right thing was not to do it, and there wasn't even a gray area, which, you know, I think is questionable, even if you had that, someone like the Baron would still make machines happen.
Yeah,
and so I don't really adhere to that. And the other really cool space or science fiction concept I really liked about this is space travel and the idea of folding space.
Yeah.
Because it's like, no, we can't really actually travel faster than light. What we do is bend space around us, and essentially, like, because two pieces of the paper of space are touching each other, we just, you know, we start push on one through side of it, and then we are on suddenly on the other.
You know?
And I think that's pretty fantastic. Just a neat concept to make things so that in-person movement is faster than any kind of electronic style communication.
Yeah.
You know, and it brings couriers back and again, makes it feel of a piece to this whole, you know, fiefdom style of government governing.
So. Yeah. It's interesting. It's kind of, in the Ender's Game series, it's kind of inverted, right? They have instantaneous communication and relativistic travel, but the relativistic travel, you know, has a serious cost in time.
Yes, absolutely. It's funny because, of course, those are topics I like, but they're just not that important to this novel.
Right. Well, even when you look at the navigators, you know, in the original film and in the sci-fi miniseries, they decided we need to show a guild navigator, you know, however mutated they are. Where in the book, it just kind of says, we think they're probably mutated, but you're not allowed to ask about them. You're not allowed to see them.
Right. The only real significance of the guild is that, hey, they control movement. And right. Therefore, that's why they are a political power in this space. And the mechanism isn't all that important other than how it plays into all the other aspects of communication and so on.
Yeah. And that kind of gets into the spice is oil.
Yes.
Thing.
Which we've talked about remarkably little, actually.
Yeah.
It's probably the most obvious parallel in this entire thing. I mean, as a teenager reading this, I read it and I was like, oh, look, spice is oil. And it was the other stuff that was, you know, much more intricate and much less obvious, because I feel like people use the oil parallel a lot in
Yeah, and like you said, it is kind of obvious. It's the, oh, look, it's a desert with a resource that's controlled by people who speak some kind of Arabic language.
Right.
And it's kind of low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, exactly. And it enables luxury and things that people see as necessary and travel.
or even when they're manufacturing plastics from it.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
It really ties in pretty well, but I'm okay that we didn't really talk about that too much.
Right.
So one kind of subheading that I have in my notes is wild speculation. Sometimes you hear science fiction and fantasy and genre fiction discussed as speculative fiction. And kind of like you've said with some of Asimov and some older science fiction that's very of its time, you'll often get these predictions for future technology that are just hilariously off. And so that's kind of what I want to talk about in wild speculation. The only problem is Dune doesn't really do that.
Yeah.
And kind of like I mentioned earlier, because of its not relying on being hard science fiction or really even any particular technology, it makes it really something that, like I said, is not going to age badly. It's aged really well in that sense. Some of the social stuff, like we've talked about, maybe there's some aging there. But in terms of tech, it just didn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think the only things that really... maybe a little bit surprising. I mean, we mentioned, of course, I don't buy the social and human aspect of the fact that they wouldn't develop robots, but it wasn't that they never had that technology. It's that they had it and turned away from it. And by proxy, you can think the same thing of like electronics in general and computers and communication and so on. I do suspect that maybe they'd have a little bit more on planet instantaneous communication than they do. I feel like that feels a little bit off, but if you allow for the conceit and for the suspension of disbelief that, look, we just pushed away from computers out of this sort of religious vehemence that is so ingrained in humanity that we just can't turn back, then, you know, I buy it. I buy the rest of it.
Yeah, and they even go through some of that about the lack of satellite coverage.
Right.
On portions of Arrakis. And so you kind of think, well, how would they communicate? Long range radio, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's not really one of those. There's lots of like old movies and stuff where you're like, boy, if somebody had a cell phone, this movie would be 5 minutes long.
So this is something maybe you can, since you've read this more recently than me, do they talk much? Because you're right. They do talk about the lack of satellite coverage and that's actually basically a political thing. Like there are people working against getting satellite coverage because they don't want... Right. You know, the powers that be to know what's going on around the planet. But do they talk about how that's used on other planets that don't have people working against that? I forget.
No. If anything, it's just kind of by implication that normally the guild would have their eyes on any place that was important. But they pay serious amounts of spice bribes to the guild, and that's their coin, right? So I don't know why the guild would go along with it other than if there's a threat against the spice, which there really doesn't come in until... Paul realizes that he who can destroy a thing controls a thing.
That's true. And I do suspect that in this, too, some of why the guild might go along is, I mean, you think about the Chome Company and just kind of the way that they handle spice itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it gives the guild that much more leverage. It's like, well, if we have sort of our own spice, you know, source, we can... resist bending a little bit more to, you know, for various other things, for various other economic discussions and so on. So, and it really is just that valuable. Like it is much more valuable in this world than oil is in ours.
Yes. Yeah. Because it is possible to travel without oil. It's just we're dependent on it because we're dependent on it. And that's because we have failed to have the political will to move away from it.
Right. Whereas in this world, in the world of Dune, if spice were to disappear, interstellar travel would essentially be gone as well.
Yeah.
A whole lot of people would start dying sooner because they have extended lives due to spice. And there's a whole lot of other stuff going on there.
Yeah. Well, and it's a poison, right? And essentially, if you stop taking it, then it's not just that your lifespan is shortened, but the people who are addicted to it then would have a rough time as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So one other thing that I like to look at is what competition the book was up against. The year of the Hugo, of course, for me, I kind of look at this and I'm like, there's no question this should have been the winner, but it wasn't the unanimous winner.
It tied. Was it? It was the first tie, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fascinating too, because there were only, I'm not looking at the list right now, but there were 5 nominees, I think, and 2 of them tied. One of the other nominees actually won the following year because it was serialized and therefore could be nominated 2 years in a row. So apparently it was a strong year. I actually have not read any of the other nominees, and it feels like Dune has definitely lasted the test of time and earned its spot.
I'm curious, have you read And Call Me Conrad or This Immortal by Radio Zelazny, which is a really hard name to pronounce?
I have not. I would really like to. I think it's Canticle for Leibowitz by Zelazny. I have that on my shelf. It was loaned by a friend and I just haven't gotten to it. And it's been over a year, so I should probably get to that.
Yeah, no, that's by a different author. I'm looking at the list, so I'm cheating. But Walter M. Miller is Canticle for Leibowitz.
And there is another Zelazny book.
Lord of Light.
That's the one I have. Yeah. Sorry. That's the one I have on my shelf. So I have both of those books on my shelf. But cool. I knew the author name, but I haven't read him at all. I have read Heinlein, who...
Oh, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress?
No. I've read him as an author, and okay. I actually was a little bit put off. I haven't read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. So, but of course, my own biases, and of course, when I read other stuff by Heinlein, probably means I should go back to it. I haven't actually read any of these nominees, and I wish I had.
Yeah, no, I hadn't either. And I've read a little bit of Heinlein myself, just a couple, mostly short fiction, actually. I've not read a lot of his novels, just Starship Troopers.
I think the only novel I've read is A Stranger in a Strange Land.
Ooh, that's an interesting one.
It is. It's one I'm glad to have read.
Yeah, I have not read it. And that's one of those ones. And like I was talking to Colin on the first episode, I'm like, there's a lot of these where I'm like, I would like to have read them, but I'm not sure I want to read them.
I did not enjoy reading it at any point, but once I was done, I was glad I had read it. I mean, hey, I understand where the term grok comes from because of it. So,
right. And I'm culturally aware of that as well. But, and this is kind of something that we talked about on the first episode as well, is kind of looking over the list. And there's some of these that I worry are going to be so of their time that they're going to be hard to enjoy. And I'm going to have to put myself in that mindset. To just, you know what, this is of its time and that's okay. Just enjoy it for what it is. Yeah. And I was delighted that The Demolished Man was not one of those. I mean, it is of its time, but it was a very enjoyable read. But one of the things that when we were emailing and you mentioned that Asimov was your favorite author, I listened to Foundation a while back and it did nothing for me. And it sounds like it's not your favorite Asimov.
No, it's nowhere near my favorite. I had already gotten into, I started to get into Asimov during high school as well, actually. I needed to find something to write a research paper on, and I found some recommended pairings, probably on the internet, although I think I was on dial-up at the time, but still had the internet. Yeah. I just found some recommended pairings of books, and somebody recommended iRobot, the collection of short stories, along with another novel, and I don't even remember what it was. And I just grabbed on to iRobot and slowly worked through... I mean, I don't know how many of his works I've read now. So many of them. I have so many out-of-print novels, things that back then, the only way I could find them was to get them on eBay. And I have duplicates of books because the only ways I could get certain ones was to buy them in bundles with other books. And I only really got to Foundation because people said I needed to read Foundation.
Right.
And
kind of the same way with me.
Yeah. And so I appreciate some of the larger thematic elements of the Foundation trilogy, but... they are nowhere near my favorites of his work. And honestly, I remember very little, and I've read the series twice. It just doesn't stick with me. Part of it might be that there's not much in the way of characterization. And I like characters a lot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and that's one thing I like about his robot books, is that I feel like the robots come off as characters in a really interesting way.
Exactly. And the people involved, too, when you get to the robot novels, you have...
Elijah Bailey.
Elijah Bailey. Yeah. And it's great. And so the Foundation series is, I mentioned it earlier as something that people might like this if they like Foundation, but it's sort of the drier elements of Foundation that are the reasons people like Foundation are in this, but this is still much more intricate and so on. And and so I would recommend sort of toughing it out through the Foundation series. But if you didn't like the first one, I do think you might like the second and third ones a little bit more. There's a little bit more in the way of characters. Like, there's basically one character I remember, and it's from later in the series.
Right.
And that's fine. But one of the things that really gives to me, and it's sort of a novel thing that's maybe even a little bit immature, but the kind of immature nerd in me likes a lot, is that over time, Asimov slowly filled in the universe such that the robot and Foundation universes became one universe.
Right.
And I actually really love the way he did that. It just really, some of it is a little bit, I wouldn't say ham-fisted, but a little bit rough around the edges. But in the end, if you kind of work your way through it, and I mostly read it in chronological order, in universe chronological order, I really enjoyed it a lot. And it ties it together, and it makes me kind of feel like, okay, I needed to have read the Foundation ones just to understand that position in sort of sci-fi history.
Yeah.
But also to be able to really like some of these other characters later on. So, yeah. So I would recommend sticking with it if you can.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to if anybody ever wants to talk about Foundation's Edge, which is one of the Hugo winners.
Right.
So I've got some homework before I can really read that. And there's a few on here like that where, you know, they're sequels. Or in a series somewhere other than number one. So.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of sequels, just I think, you know, we touched on some of the other Dune books, and you know, I mentioned that none of them are really that important, but probably if you can tough it out, there are interesting concepts in Dune Messiah that, of course, you know, we talked about with Paul exploring sort of his responsibility for the religious movement he's created, and it definitely explores that a lot, but that becomes essentially the only significant theme in it, and sort of his, does he avoid deification or not?
Right.
How does he manage this? And then later on, Children of Dune and God Emperor of Dune are a piece, and it explores kind of the concept that I, as a teenager, thought was super novel, and of course was not. Many people have explored this after otherwise, but the concept of sort of how do you unite humanity for its own good, and sort of if you really know better, if you can see the future and other people don't, well, then you're going to have to do things that inherently make you seem like the enemy of everybody, right? Because you can't give them the choice because, you know, it could lead to its own destruction. And it does very much lead into how can someone who sees the future and sees that humanity may very well not survive as a species, how does he do what needs to be done in order to make sure that humanity survives? And how will he be perceived as others who literally just cannot see things from his perspective and that will never see it from his perspective? So I thought that was a really neat concept. It's worth exploring. And kind of that's sort of how the Foundation itself is explored a little bit and some of the conflict that comes into there with some of its sequels. So there are definitely a lot of ties between the two series and how they kind of focus on destiny and being able to see the future or predict the future and how that plays into things and how human elements of the choices, even with the people who can see that, because they're not machines, right? They're people with their own desires.
Yeah. So. Well, I think we're about wrapped here.
I think so too.
So how can people get a hold of you?
They can follow me on Twitter at Auhim. That's AUHIM. And they can follow me and Mandy at Trivially Crucial. You can find that anywhere that you get podcasts. So
cool. And I have Mandy signed up to do something probably later summertime.
Well, that's exciting. I get to talk to her a lot about these kinds of things, and I don't get to hear her talk to other people about this sort of thing often enough, because I feel like she and I have enough of a read on each other that I sometimes forget what thoughts she has that might be novel to other people. Just we've known each other for so long now.
All right. Well, Michael, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And it's always a pleasure to get to talk to Dune about people because I don't get to do it often.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, take care. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I definitely encourage you to head to triviallycrucial.com and check out Michael and Mandy's podcast. And as I mentioned earlier, Mandy will likely be guesting sometime this summer, which should be fun because we're going to be talking about one of my favorite books. And I'm not going to tell you any more about that at the moment. In the meantime, I want to ask you to follow us on social media. So facebook.com/Hugo's Podcast. On Twitter, it's @Hugo's Podcast. And if you want to get in touch over email, it's feedback@Hugo'sPodcast.com. And of course, I would love it if you are enjoying this, if you would leave us a review in iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play. That would help get more ears on the show. And another great idea, actually, is to follow the podcast on Goodreads. So that's goodreads.com/Hugo's Podcast. You'll notice I was completely consistent with the social media username. But following us on Goodreads will give you a view into what I'm reading next. However, in this case, I'm just going to tell you what I'm doing next. Right now, I am reading Hyperion, which was the book of choice for Jeff Palermo of Sci-Fi on Screen, and we will be talking about that in the coming weeks. So look forward to that. And that'll do it, I think. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.